Voordat we beginnen met de aflevering, eerst dit. Wil jij ontdekken hoe andere organisaties nieuwe medewerkers verwelkomen? Ben je benieuwd naar de nieuwste onboarding trends? Kom naar Onboard Amsterdam, het grootste onboarding event van Europa op 14 november. Met 1000 HR-professionals, ruim 15 inspirerende sprekers en interactieve sessies. PeoplePower is er ook om podcasts op te nemen en jij als PeoplePower luisteraar krijgt een speciale korting van 30%. Koop nu je tickets via onboardamsterdam.nl en gebruik de code PeoplePower aan elkaar. Zie ik je op 14 november?
Hoe ontketen je de kracht van mensen in organisaties? PeoplePower brengt je de laatste wetenschappelijke inzichten en praktijkvoorbeelden. Over leiderschap en leren. Betrokkenheid en bevlogenheid. Inzetbaarheid en inclusie. Omdat mensen het verschil maken in jouw organisatie. PeoplePower met Glenn van der Burg.
There's a lot of attention for diversity in the media. For example, the public opinion does not accept a talk show table full of white middle-aged men anymore. This trend is also reflected within organizations. Diversity programs, diversity managers, or even departments, and a whole army of diversity consultants. But does all this attention lead to the right results, the right culture, and the right working environment? The terms equity and inclusion were probably added for a reason. So how can you make your hiring process, your working environment, your meetings, etc. truly inclusive? We invited two experts. Simon Doak is Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Education Manager at PVH. And Sanja Subbamal is People Strategy Consultant at Effectory. Thanks for listening to this international version of People Power.
People Power with Glenn van den Burg.
Sanja and Simon, great to have you on the show. Always nice to have an English version of it. It's always interesting for me to use not my native tongue in the show. So there's a lot of, thank God, I would say, there's a lot of attention for diversity everywhere in the media, but also, of course, within organizations. Simon, it's your job to do this within PVH.
Yeah.
How do you see this tidal wave of attention coming over organizations? How do you look at it? Is it a positive thing?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'll start by saying thank you so much for actually having us here.
Sure.
It's great to get the opportunity to talk about a topic, I think, like you said, that's very hot on everyone's lips at the moment. For the listeners that aren't so familiar, PVH is actually the company that's responsible for Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein. So I'll probably be taking a very fashion-led approach on it. But I think definitely within our industry and what we've seen the changes in even the last 5 years, it's much more apparent now for apparel industry to be more inclusive of different races, religions, sexualities, genders, whatever it may be. It's something that's it's been a hot topic for us.
Yeah. Sanja?
Yeah. Also, thank you very much for having me here, Glenn. And I think it's incredible that this topic is becoming more and more popular and that everyone is talking about it. So the approach that I will take is working as a consultant in Effectory. I work with a lot of organizations across different industries, different sizes. And what you see is that this topic is becoming very important. And a lot of people want to do a lot in this topic, but the question is, how do we do it? How do we get the conversation started? How do we create the impact that we want? So
we passed the question, should we do anything?
Because, well, that was taken for granted. We should.
Definitely. Yeah, 100%,
of
yes.
Of course. But I think if we go back 10 years ago, a lot of organizations maybe still said, well, it's a nice to have, but we're past it.
We're totally past,
it. You cannot do anything anymore.
Sure. I think you definitely see the change. I think within Gen Z and the millennial generations, there's definitely a bigger call out for it. It's something that they look for in an employer of choice. I think it's quite commonly known that people will turn down jobs if they don't see an authentic representation of diversity and inclusion within an organization. It's something that we see a lot of, and actually how do you attract the best talent is by making sure that you're not just diverse and you're inviting everyone to the table, but you're actually doing it in an inclusive and authentic way. And you see that a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And given the fact that in a few years, 75% of your population is going to be with the Gen Z population and the millennial population, we see that this is an incredibly important factor for the retention of employees from these generations. So it's very important that we see what is it, how do we authentically do this work? It's not in just a performative way that we do it because it's in vogue now and everyone is talking about it and we don't want to get left behind in the conversation. But how do we create that authentic, non-performative action?
Yeah. And you also already said, Sanjay, that it's in the how, it's in the steps that you take, it's in the... Well, authentic is one of the words that you used. So what do you see as maybe a side effect of all this attention for diversity and all these companies and organizations frantically taking steps to do something because they're left behind? They just didn't start soon enough, probably.
Well, the side effect is exactly like how you phrased it, that we're all scrambling to get something done, but we don't have that focus of what do we want to get done? What are the goals that we're trying to achieve? Are we just doing it because everyone around me is doing it? Everyone is talking about it, so I don't want to fall behind in the public discourse. So that's first thing to keep in mind is that what are you trying to achieve? Who are you trying to include in the conversation now that you previously didn't really think about? And how are we going to create that accountability within organizations so that it doesn't become a trend topic that everyone's talking about it now? So we do it now, but what happens when the topic turns to something else trendy? Do we forget about DEI? So how do we establish that accountability and specific metrics so that this is an ongoing change, whether it's trendy to talk about it or not?
And what you even see, Simon, I heard somebody a few years ago that was working on diversity said, first we focus on women and LGBT community. And I was like, oh, so everybody else is left behind.
Yeah. And I think that comes back to the why. For me, it always starts with why do you do something? And so often you hear this phrase, and so often as an HR professional, I've heard it many times. Oh, we need more blank people at the table. Fill in the blank in whatever way you will. Mm-hmm. For me, as a queer person, I heard sort of, oh yeah, we need another gay guy at the table. Mm-hmm. We need that perspective. Mm-hmm. And actually, why? What are they going to be contributing to the business, to the conversation, to your organization in general? And if you can't answer that why, if your executive team, your leaders can't answer, why do we want to do this? Why do we actually bring it back to these people? I think that's the starting point. It's not just about ticking a box for a number and saying, okay, cool, we've invited these people to the table. Yep, we have the representation. It's actually giving them a voice at the table as well too. So really being able to articulate, why do we want to have a diverse talent pool within our own organization?
Yeah. And that's the authenticity, right? It's not just for the optics that we invite someone to the table, but we also give them that power, that decision-making power and influence to create that change from their perspective.
Yeah, definitely. Right?
And Sanjay, I think it has a name, doesn't it?
Yes. And that comes to the point that what we want to talk and deep dive a little bit today, and that is intersectionality. So...
Second to that, that goes kind of hand in hand, is of course then tokenism. I think we can talk intersectionality, which we will explain if it's a totally new term and you've never heard of it. Don't worry.
I've never heard of it.
It's totally fine.
Yeah. We have to, of course, we do some preparation, and in the preparing talks that we had, you said, yeah, we'd like to talk about tokenism and intersectionality. And I was like, I think that's a great idea, but I have no idea what it is. So let's first address that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because or else we're talking about something that nobody knows what it is.
Yeah. So Simon, what does intersectionality mean to you?
Okay, so when I was doing some preparation for this, because I did prepare, of course, the first thing I sort of thought was, how would I explain this to my parents? So I'm originally from Northern Ireland, so I grew up with one Irish parent, one British parent, and very traditional sort of household who are also not so familiar with the term intersectionality. So I thought, okay, how would I actually explain this to them? And I think the best and the easiest way is to take just the first part of the word, intersection. And essentially what an intersection is where things meet, where things join, where things cross over. What intersectionality is actually looking at all of the different facets of your being and appreciating those facets for whatever they are. And looking at where they cross over. So for me, whenever I look at it myself as a member of the LGBT plus community, I also look at it from a religious standpoint as well too, and also from an immigrant standpoint. I haven't lived at home for a very long time, not giving away my age, but for quite some time. So I kind of look at what are the intersections in my life that put me in a particular place in society. Yeah. And we'll come to, I think we'll talk about.
And you already had two intersections when your parents fell in love with each other.
Yeah, it's if
because
you're...
Because, I mean, if you know anything about Northern Ireland, then you know that, there's a bit of a dispute. There was a bit of a dispute between the British and the Irish.
Yeah.
So the Protestants and the Catholics.
Yeah.
And that's one intersection that you have.
Yeah, definitely.
So I can imagine that if you are talking with your Northern Irish friends and they're mostly Catholic and they're not talking so nicely about the Protestant part, and you're feeling, okay, yeah, but that's also within me.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And I think that's something I felt a lot as a kid growing up, working or living and going to school in very mixed surroundings. It's which group do you go with? Do you go with the Protestant side or the Catholic side? And that's really what intersectionality looks at, is that I was not just one thing. Mm. I was actually neither, because my parents couldn't agree on which one to go Protestant or Catholic. So I got nothing. So then that kind of... So then that kind of put, like, where do I go? Do I pick the Protestant side, the Catholic side, or do I just create my own little path? And I think that's a good sort of way that, to show what intersectionality can actually look like, even from a very young age.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about, we had a discussion about adopted children that have white parents, who are colored themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's also one of the intersections. So you are Dutch.
Yeah.
Because your parents are white and you're probably brought up in a really Dutch fashion, but you also have another background. From your biological parents, so that's also an intersection.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm always talking when I'm trying to understand something. No. Sanja, would you like to add? What's your perspective on intersectionality?
So intersectionality, the first time, if I honestly started thinking about it, is after I moved to the Netherlands. So I'm from India, and I moved to the Netherlands around now 8 years ago already. And the most
and how's your Dutch? Everybody asks
this
the first question.
That's always the question.
This is the first
how's
question.
Your Dutch?
I can cycle really well. Let's say that's how I integrate it. So when I think about intersectionality, it's always thinking about no person is just one thing. I am not just a woman, right? I am a woman of color who is an immigrant living in the Netherlands, and I also so it is the intersection of different identities. Some identities are privileged, for example, I am able-bodied woman, and some identities are more historically marginalized communities, which is the person of color and a woman. Right. So intersectionality really talks to that everybody is unique, that you can't box people into, okay, you're a woman, but within being a woman, there are multiple experiences. You can be disabled. You can be from a lower social economic status. You can be from a higher education background. So like there are different elements that play into that, right? So that for me is very important to understand first when we talk about intersectionality in the workplace, because we need to understand that when we create policies and DI initiatives, there is no one size fits all. There is no one hiring procedure that's going to benefit, let's say, one identity a lot, right?
Yeah. No, you make an excellent point. I think with that it's something to keep in mind when you think of the topic DEI. Sometimes you do just lean towards marginalized groups or communities. And actually, this intersectionality topic applies to every single person. I think it's a good opportunity to everyone to self-reflect on what makes you, what makes you special, what makes you great, and actually look and recognize where have you had privilege in your life. Mm-hmm. And I, as a white man, have had a lot of privilege that some of my friends haven't had. And I even see that today, living in very progressive Amsterdam, you still see sometimes the differences that you get from just that one intersection of my race.
Yeah, because it's not only the fact that there are different things that make you, that add up to your identity. And I can even imagine that, well, in some situations you are more, you use more of your, of a part of your identity than in other situations. But it also comes with the marginalized part.
Yes.
So when are you privileged and when are you marginalized? And that makes it a part of about this topic about diversity, equity and inclusion.
Absolutely. And I have a really good example to explain this further. So we have the gender pay gap, which is the very real fact that women are paid less for the work, the same work for the same hours. There is a huge gender pay gap in all over the world in differing rates, depending on which country you're in. In the Netherlands, for example, the most recent data that I saw from 2020, the gender pay gap is around 14%, meaning that women are paid 14% less than men for the same work, for the same hours put into it, right? And so when we take this, there was another study done in the US that women are paid 81 cents for every dollar paid to men, right? And this is great that we have the statistic. But if you want to do it from an intersectional lens, you need to see that women of color, for example, black women, are paid even less, which is 75 cents for every dollar that's paid to a man. So this is where that looking at different issues from an intersectional sense becomes very important.
And I also learned that fathers, when a white man becomes a father, it even gets worse. So women that get children, then the pay gap gets larger, and it even gets larger if men get children. So women with children get paid less, and men with children get paid more than men without children.
Yeah,
which is really crazy. Okay.
Yeah.
In a bit, we'll start talking about the other topic because we also have another new word that we have learned, tokenism. Mm-hmm. So we also have to address that, but we'll talk about it in a minute.
Leiderschap, leren, inzetbaarheid en inclusie. De laatste inzichten hoor je in People Power.
Simon Doak of PVH, the company behind or above, I don't know where to put it. To
above,
put it
mother, above, mother company.
The mother company of Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein. And Sanja Subamal of Factory, our friends, of course, of the show. We're talking about, we're talking about intersectionality. I've learned a new word. Before we go to tokenism, one of the things that I can imagine that our listeners are thinking right now is, oh my God, it just got even more complicated. We have all these groups in our big organization. You have to have a big organization. We have a group for women. We have a group for disabled people. We have a group for the LGBT plus community. We have a group for the non-Western European background, which is also very difficult to explain without using words that you don't want to use. Mm-hmm. So now we have the intersectionality. Oh, guys, help us out. Help us out.
Okay, I promise it starts much easier. And I think particularly with intersectionality, it's kind of taking it back to where was the actual concept coined from. I think is one of the key places to start. So it was actually back in 1989. So it's been around for quite some time.
It's old.
I was born in 1989.
Really?
You just called me old.
Now we know.
There you exposed yourself.
Now we know how old you are.
Oh, no, I'm just old. That's going to have to be cut out. But it was actually started back in 1989 by Kimberly Crenshaw. And where it really was from was that what Kimberly was actually seeing was that there was lots of progression being made on women in the workplace. So there was lots of movements to make sure there was equal pay, equal opportunities, and there was more representation across the board. She was also seeing that in terms of racial diversity, that was also on the rise, which was great. What she did notice is that it was only picking the sort of the first thought whenever you hear women in the workplace and whenever you hear racial diversity, it was picking people off a level of privilege, generally white women in the workplace, and black men. Mm. So what she was noticing was, okay, well, actually, where do I sit? I'm a woman, but I'm not necessarily represented. And I'm also of African-American descent. So where do I sit? And that's where intersectionality came from. She's like, I'm not just one thing, I'm two. And the problem was all of these different policies, procedures, things that were being put into place weren't actually helping her. They weren't helping in any way because she was still being excluded from that narrative.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that history that Simon told us, when we talk about intersectionality, like Simon said, it's been around for a long time, right? And I think a lot of us also know this intuitively, like, because we are all more than one dimension. So we know this. So now we have a word for what we already intuitively know. And yes, to answer your question, Glenn, DEI work is very messy and it is always evolving. You know, what we considered as good DEI work 10 years ago is maybe not up to par at the moment, right? So what I would say with the evolving nature of DEI, oh, this is another complexity added to the sea of words that we already have to know, is prioritizing constant education, that constant awareness, that constantly keeping up with what's happening in this topic is very important if you want to create that meaningful change, right? Because now we're coming up with these new words, but it's there. It's a very human experience. It's
I'm just thinking about it in the back of my head. Maybe the basis of it all is that it reflects the fact that we are working together with a lot of people in large organizations that we just don't know. We just don't know them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just met. Mm-hmm. We have to meet a little bit more before I really know you. But from that moment on, you're just Sanja, you're not in any box anymore.
Yeah,
I think that's the difference, and that's the problem. I think with large organizations that you have to do things for large groups of people, or else you would be doing for all the individuals something else. And that's, people think that that's not possible.
Yeah, and it's exactly that. That's the word that you used, right? Like, you know, how do we... Intersectionality is about not boxing people into these large boxes like a woman or person of color or disabled or whatever the box is, right? And also keeping in mind that whenever we think of a DEI initiative or a policy, there is no one-size-fits-all approach that we can take. So that makes the discussion even more complicated. We can't have 100 policies for every unique individual in the organization, right? So it's also thinking about making the conversation more nuanced and not making it just black and white. That's what this does.
What's going wrong if we do not address intersectionality? What's the negative impact?
So the negative impact is, again, like how Simon said, there can be certain communities, certain identities, certain individuals who feel totally unheard and as a result can become quickly quite disengaged with the organization.
Okay.
So again, for example, if you have a wonderful policy that is for, let's say, the LGBTQ community, but you don't really look at the intersectionality. Do you see, are they coming from a person of color? Are they disabled? If you don't look at that, it can the policies can quickly become very static and inauthentic. And even though the intention is there to create good change, the result would be that you're actually not really creating that change with which you started the intention.
Yeah.
Right. So that's something that we always need to keep in the back of the head. Who is this for? And is it reaching the people that I intend this to reach it?
Mm. Yeah.
And Simon, did you see signs of this happening within your organization?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. And you make an excellent point there. Brings something to mind. Like even when you mentioned about sort of the history of DEI and how it's evolved over the years, one thing that we've seen, particularly within PVH, is a very diverse organization. So our Amsterdam office here has 86 different nationalities under one roof, and it's 2,200
Amsterdam
people.
Is the European head office, I think.
Yes. Yeah. So we run Tommy Hilfiger globally from here and Calvin Klein EMEA. So we see a huge amount of diversity. And one of the first initiatives we took on sort of this DEI journey was creating business resource groups. And I'm sure it's something that everyone is familiar with that's listening. But for those of you who are not, it's essentially groups for those marginalized communities within the organization to kind of create a sense of community, look for education moments, look for learning moments, which has been a fantastic thing to be part of and to see it grow and to see it evolve. And what we are seeing now is what's next. And we're getting more of that what's next. It's not enough just to have look at, like you said, one intersection. How do these groups start to kind of come together and bridge these intersectional gaps? And how do they start to make sure that we're catering for all and not just certain segments?
Yeah, because I also can imagine, we know that if you are within a large organization and you put people together and you say, well, now you are the department and this is your name. And, even if you give them a shirt, that's even worse.
Yeah.
Then they feel that we are part of our tribe, and everything outside of the tribe is a bit of hostile.
Yeah, it becomes that.
You also have that, of course, with these business resource groups.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I always, because I'm white, I'm middle aged, and I'm a man, so I can never go.
You can definitely go.
Yeah. And that's why 100%. I said it, because I my wife goes to these women meetings, and I want to come with you. I'm so curious about what's happening and what's talked about. And she said, well, you can just come. But I see it's a women's group. She said, no, we're talking about women within the organization, but you can come, of course.
I think that's the perfect mindset to have, is that mindset of wanting to learn, having that desire. If you have that mindset, then yeah, for sure. I think you can definitely join these groups. I'm part of like all of them. And I even had this week, someone was like, oh, you signed up for the Asian Alliance group, but you're from Ireland. And I'm like, yeah, but I still want to learn about Asian hate. I want to learn what it's like to be part of that community and to learn from their culture. So it's a great education moment. So,
but I can imagine you're one of the few.
Actually, yeah, I was surprised. I think there was more openness on some of the other groups. But I think when you start to get to specifics, it is met with that little bit of reservation of, am I welcome? Should I be there? Am I invading a space that's not necessarily for me?
Yeah.
And to that, I would say 100% no. I think this is the start, is learning, education, having that desire to find out more. Is better than saying, okay, no, I'm just going to ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Glenn, you bring up something very interesting for me, is what I've noticed is when in this conversation about DEI, I feel white men particularly, and white able-bodied cisgendered men particularly, feel left out of this conversation, thinking, where do we fit into this conversation? And in my opinion, I feel you have one of the biggest roles to play in terms of allyship, in terms of educating yourself, in terms of advocating for people who have maybe less privilege than you, right? And it's exactly like how your wife put it, like, you know, she invited you for this. So it's just, so everyone, every white man has maybe someone that they care about, which is from a different set of intersectionality to them, that you want to learn more about. Maybe it's your wife, maybe it's your sister, maybe it's your mother, maybe it's a friend that you want to know more about in terms of understanding their intersectionalities, right? And it's so beautiful that you do that, Simon, that you sign up for different, you infiltrate
it's
other...
It's that curiosity. I just want to know. I like to be involved in like everything.
And that's what it is, right? It's just about educating yourself about a perspective that you don't have, right? And that's where the change happens. That's how allyship happens.
Yeah. So we made a promise to also talk about tokenism. How does that fit in?
So tokenism is also something that's been around for a long time, and maybe a lot of us are even experiencing it, but you just don't know it's called tokenism. So a pitfall of intersectionality is basically tokenism. So tokenism is the fact that, if I have to explain it with an example, so a lot of the times we hear in the C level, oh, we need a woman. And where are we going to find a woman? And just to tick that box, that is tokenism. Mm. When you bring someone onto the board because you want to tick a box for that optics, but you don't really give that person that decision-making power or that giving them that influence to make important decisions within the organization. That is tokenism. So it's just for optics, but not real influence within the organization. And you see tokenism in a wider context in many ways. And even before I learned this word, my first experience with tokenism is The Simpsons, the cartoon Simpsons.
Really?
Oh, yes. I know where you're going with this. I think I have a similar example. I'll tell afterwards.
Help me out.
So in the Simpsons, there is this character called Apu, which is supposed to be the token Indian character. So there is only one brown character of Indian origin called Apu. And how this character is portrayed is more like a caricature. It's more like a extreme stereotype of the Indian culture and of how an Indian is. And even though I saw the representation of someone brown skinned in a largely white show, I never felt represented by this character. I never felt I could relate with this character on the show. And that is tokenism, where it's done for the optics, but it doesn't really represent who you are.
I had exactly the same example, I think, growing up with Sex and the City. I think everyone has watched Sex and the City at some point.
The gay best friend trope.
The gay best friend, the token gay guy. The token gay guy that's flamboyant, wildly dressed. It's always a representation of someone of wealth or a higher socioeconomic status as well. And it's always the same token flamboyant.
Let me guess, he probably had a very creative job.
Yes, worked in marketing or design or hair and fashion. And again, to your point, that's not something that I ever saw. I saw the character and I thought, oh, is that what I'm supposed to be? Is that what I should be? And it kind of puts that into your head of, okay, is this what all that there is? And actually what we know from the queer community is it looks a lot different for a lot of different people. So yeah, it totally resonates with me that you mentioned that.
Well, one of the things that when you in the preparation, you talked about tokenism, which came into my mind was Bridgerton. And I don't know if it's the right example. I was just thinking, no, I should rephrase that. I don't know what to think. That is the biggest thing. I just don't know what to think. You see this historical context and you see people with dark colored skin in it. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, yeah, well, I don't mind. I'm okay. I can go with the storyline, but I'm just curious how you look at that.
Sanjay, I'll let you go for, I think as someone who's half British, I have a very particular view on it. So I'm going to let you go first because I might have a slight biased opinion on it. So I'll let you go first.
We do have two different perspectives on this topic. So what I say is, when we talk about tokenism, it's not necessarily a bad thing always, right? Mm. There are some contexts where it just naturally happens. For example, when a company is starting to become more and more diverse, it is natural that there will be few people from certain underrepresented communities who are quite few in number compared to the majority population. And they do, in that process, become tokens.
Yeah.
So in that line of thinking, when you think about media representation, where it has been largely white white characters and white stories that have been told are overrepresented in media. I'm okay with the performative nature of it. It does feel performative to a certain extent, right? Because we need to have that representation. Everyone's doing it, so we need to have more diversity in the cast. So it does, to an extent, seem performative and seem inauthentic. But is that necessarily a bad thing? My perspective is that it is not, because we need to get started somewhere, right? Yeah. And we need to normalize how that looks in the larger media. It's okay to have someone who's a queen who's black, for example. It's fine. And it's okay to have a black mermaid, Ariel, right? Yeah. It's okay to have black elves. Yeah. Right. So it's just normalizing that to the point where we don't see it as something that stands out. In that aspect, I'm okay with it.
You're referring to Lord of the Rings, of course, also.
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Yeah. But exactly. The big difference for me was that I was like,
it looks weird.
No, it's a historical context. So they're not real stories. They're made up stories, but they're in a historical context. So you're like, huh? Okay. Historically, this isn't right. And what happened in my head is that, okay, and is that a problem? Okay, they probably want to say something with this. They did it on purpose. Why is this happening to me? So I didn't even listen to the story anymore. I was just confused.
Yeah, I think for me, there's certain aspects of it I definitely mirror. I think just from the storyline in general, the royal family, the history and everything behind that. I think firstly, it was great to finally see some representation of diversity within that sort of monarchy space, which has historically never been there. So I think from that aspect, great. For me, I felt it was too performative. I felt that there was no, it kind of comes back to that why that I mentioned a little bit earlier. Why did they choose to do it? Did they do it to tick a box and say, oh, we have to have 40% of our cast need to be from the BIPOC community. So we tick a box. And for me, that's what it felt like. They were ticking a box and they had nowhere else to put it. And they thought, okay, this is a great chance to get some free publicity. Everyone will be talking that we turned the monarchy into a person of color. So for me, it felt a little bit inauthentic. I will say I don't know the full context, the story behind the producers, the director, what their thought was. But for me, as someone not knowing it and looking at it, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
On the other side, there's another show on Netflix you might have seen called Beef. It just recently came out and the entire cast is Asian American. And it's, I think, a perfect example of it done well. It looks at Asian culture. It looks at what it's like to be Asian American. It moved the narrative from the token Asian character, just to bring it back to tokenism, and actually let you focus on the other aspects of these people. Mm-hmm. So what it's like to be a driven, career-driven, ambitious woman in a predominantly male-led field, and what's it like to be the lazy tech guy that likes Bitcoin and things like that. So you focused on them as a being, them as a person, their culture, their experiences, not their race. And I think that was a perfect example of it done well. Bridgerton, to me, on the other side, not so much.
I totally understand that. Like, you know, with Beef, they were well-rounded, real characters that people could relate with. Whereas, like, you know, in Bridgerton, it does seem very superficial, right? Yeah. But having said that, again, like, you know, as long as we get the conversation started, it's good. But if the conversation ends there, I think that's where that would be problematic, right? That we go beyond that to talk about specific Asian American stories, black stories, people of color stories, people with disabilities, that we give an authentic point of view from these identities. We need to progress to that. And I see this as a step to that.
All right. In a bit, we'll be talking about making this practical, because I can imagine that your head is spinning like mine is at the moment. So how can we set the first steps towards a more inclusive organization, knowing that we have these things called intersectionality and tokenism, and that you will hear within a bit.
Hoe ontketen je de kracht van mensen in organisaties? People power.
We gotta get us some English jingles.
We can help you with that.
Because is not really inclusive. No. You guys are like, what was in the jingle? We don't know. You're living in the Netherlands. You should learn a bit Dutch. Come on. Simon Doak of PVH, the organization, the mother organization of Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein. And Sanja Subamal, she's from a factory. Both are working in diversity, equity and inclusion. We were talking about tokenism. And also, Sanja, you said, well, there's always a bit of tokenism, because when you are the first person of color to enter a totally white organization, yeah, then you are a token of the starting point of being more diverse.
Yeah, absolutely. So when in our journey to become more diverse, tokenism is a natural part that happens in the beginning stages, and that's okay. But it's not okay to ignore the side effect that comes with feeling like a token. And I can explain that from my personal experience, is that in some of my past organizations that I've worked in the Netherlands, I've been either the first Indian to work there, or first person, a woman of color to work there. And with that, there is that pressure that you carry of your entire, that you're representing your entire community, and that you need to overperform to represent the community that you are a part of.
Like, so you feel responsible, in your case, you feel responsible for 1.2 billion?
Yeah, well, how much is it? Yeah, it's
definitely billions. Let's leave it at that. Yeah. Let's not get to
like a billion Indian
absolutely
in your culture, and you feel that
the
you have to perform in such a way that everybody will think, oh, wow.
Absolutely. And I think this is how tokens feel when they're the first in anything. Either you're the first woman of color, either you're the first disabled person, or whatever, right? The first underrepresented person in a largely, in a privileged
So you're
group.
Underrepresented, so you should overperform. That's the feeling that you have.
Whether it is an implicit or an explicit expectation, everybody, every token feels it. And I can also say that from personal experience and hearing about stories from my peers, we have that pressure to overperform, to beat those stereotypes, to beat the expectation, the preconceived notions that you would have about me. So it carries a lot of weight, and it can be incredibly damaging to the mental health of tokens.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Simon, yeah. Is that something you can relate to?
Yes and no at the same time. I think I've always worked in the fashion industry, so it's always been with Ralph Lauren, a few department store chains, and now Tommy and Calvin. And generally the population that we see is it's predominantly female led. There's a lot of that's the majority of our population, and also the LGBT plus community. You could probably, if you deep dived
so
into
if
it,
I would be, I would start working for you, then I would be underrepresented.
Actually, yes. you're actually not
that's
underrepresented in leadership positions, strangely enough.
Okay.
So when
we look at it,
yes, 60 something percent generally of some organizations are women, but when you look at their C-suite and executive level, it's probably people that look a little bit more like you.
That's so, everywhere, right, Simon?
So don't worry, if you want to be a CEO, probably.
No.
But no, I do
never.
Feel it's like, to a certain extent, I think you do have to just be conscious of, if you are the first person that's at that table, what are you contributing? And it kind of comes back to the longer term goals, I think, of the organization. If they're setting these people up for success and they're putting the right policies, procedures in place, that in the long term, you won't just be the only woman of color, or you won't just be the only gay immigrant. If that's there in the long term, then that really, it kind of eases that pressure a little bit. And that's when tokenism goes right, because you kind of get a better outcome.
Yeah. And what you said, Sanja, what I learned from you is that tokenism in the beginning, when you're starting with this, with being more diverse, then it's a natural effect. But if it stops at that, so you don't have any policies, or don't have training, or you don't do anything else, then it could be damaging.
Address it, then it does get damaging.
Yeah. All right. Final question to you. our listeners are listening to this show and they're thinking, okay, so, well, I have a very full agenda. I'm recognizing some of the things that you have been talking about. What can I do that doesn't mess up my agenda for the coming years to start changing for the good?
Okay, I think for me, Simon, definitely the first thing, it needs to start from the top. It needs to start with executive sponsorship and executive representation, that they understand the importance of having a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive environment for their teams. If your senior leadership team can't convey, why do we want to do this? How are we going to do this? And what are some of the actions? How can you expect an organization or the people that report into them to really make a difference or to make that change? It starts with them understanding, why do we want to do this?
Okay, and next to understanding it and talking about it, what should they do themselves?
Proactively put in policies, procedures, things in place that not just reactively when you bring your token person into the room, really proactively think, okay, what will these people need to be successful to make sure that their voices are heard? Have these policies and things in place to make yourself an attractive employer of choice. And then once people are in, they feel comfortable and enabled to succeed, not being set up to fail.
Okay.
And to add to that point, what I would say is, yes, it starts at the top, and representation starts at the top. So when we talk about different policies for intersectionality or tokenism, you need to hear it from a perspective of people who faced those barriers themselves. So people don't recognize barriers if they've not gone through those barriers themselves, right? Or if they've only heard about these barriers because there is a situation in the company that's become, that has escalated. So for me, what would be important is the people with key formal power within the organization, key decision-making power in the organization, need to be adequately represented to represent the workforce distribution within your organization. That is key, I would say.
Yeah. And it kind of links to like who you recruit into those positions as well, too.
Absolutely.
That it will take time. This isn't going to be an overnight thing or a quick change. It does take time, commitment, investment. And yeah, you will probably have to wait longer to recruit someone into the position if you want diversity. But good things come to those who wait. It's better to look for that diversity, hold off, than just falling back onto what we've always done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And more in the short term, what I would say, short to medium term, what I would say is having that on those moments to have that ongoing conversation about these difficult topics, right? Like race, gender, how it, tokenism, intersectionality, creating those spaces to have, I think how some companies call it is courageous conversations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. Yeah.
Courageous
conversations.
I would like to be present sometimes with that.
Courageous conversations. And just hearing different points of view. What are your blind spots? What kind of, what perspective are you missing? And hearing from different people is key. And on that note, what I also saw as a study is in different companies, for example, there is a pressure on marginalized communities to spread that education amongst the more privileged groups. And I think this is something to be aware of, that sometimes the marginalized communities, they themselves, research actually backs this up, that they themselves don't know how to have like these conversations in a structured, objective manner, right? They only know what they experience. So just because someone is a person of color, it's not that they, by default, they become an authority on all issues relating to that. So putting that pressure on them is something to be very cognizant of, being very conscious of that.
Yeah. All right. My conclusion after this short hour of talking about new words within diversity, equity, and inclusion is that the hour was too short, as always. We'll make sure we'll put some extra links to more information about intersectionality. What can you read or watch, which will be interesting, and of course about tokenism, so you can learn more. Because if I've learned one thing, is that we should be keeping ourselves educated about this subject. Simon Doak of PVH and Sanjay Subbamal of Effectree, thank you very much. and you, of course. Thanks for listening to this show.
Meer luisteren? Ga naar peoplepower.radio en abonneer je op onze podcast.